Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ebola, ISIS, snakes on a plane. There are plenty of things we can fear. But what is fear? How does it work? When is it debilitating? When is it empowering? This hour on Point, understanding fear itself. We'll go to the world of science and of extreme sports this hour, including talking with the 2013 Big Wave World Champion surfer about fear and his near-fatal accident. But first, let's just get some fear in here. Travel Channel takes a ride on the Millennium Force roller coaster at the amusement park Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio. Fear or thrill, I'm not quite sure, but this one I think we know. Here's a Monday morning in April. A big rat climbed onto a New York City subway car. Most passengers stood on their seats to avoid the floor. Now that is good old-fashioned fear. If you can see the picture, they are all up on the bench, all up on the seats on that car in New York City. Let's see. We've got with me right now someone who's really looked at fear in a wonderful way. In the studio with me, Florence Williams, contributing editor to Outside Magazine. Her article in the November issue of Outside is headlined, "The Science of Conquering Your Greatest Fears." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Florence Williams, thanks so much for coming in.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
You start out saying fear may be the oldest emotion of all. Explain that to us.
Yeah, that's right. Scientists have actually discovered fear even in sea slugs. Oh. So some of the most primitive life forms on the planet show fear. And it makes sense that we would have to be afraid of things that could hurt us in order to survive. But as we evolved, our amygdala, which is really the brain's sort of peanut-sized seat of fear, continued to have very large sway over our brains, and it continues to do so.
The first emotion, because before we understood anything, there were just things to watch out for, things to avoid, things to save ourselves from, and fear alerts us.
That's right. And in fact, fear may be the origin of all of our other emotions, which is something kind of neat to think about, because perhaps we feel joy and love and peace as a way to reduce and control the powerful sort of neurotransmitters associated with fear.
It seems like a big time for fear right now. You put up a few videos of beheadings, you get a few Ebola cases going in the United States, and suddenly it seems like there's fear all over the place.
There's fear all over the place. Sometimes it feels like the world is just about to cave in on itself. But I also think what we're seeing is an election cycle. Mm-hmm. And one thing we've learned is that politicians are brilliant at recognizing the power of the fear emotion.
Just what? To use it as a kind of crowbar, put it in there, just get that needle of fear in, and people will respond. Politicians know that.
Exactly. I mean, fear, it's an emotion. So when we're scared of something, we really pay attention.
Shout Ebola in a crowded theater.
And everyone notices.
It has your attention.
And actually, there have been some interesting neuroscience studies looking at, even the different political parties and how they respond to fear.
I mean, members of those parties.
Yeah, members of those parties. And, it's complicated when you're looking at sort of seats in the brain, locations in the brain, and what they might mean for behavior. But some of these studies have shown that when Republicans play video games, their amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain, has more activity than when Democrats play those games. So, people interpret those different ways. But certainly because we have a Democratic administration, we are definitely seeing fear being used.
What's inborn? What's culturally cultivated? I mean, you've got, among other things, this interesting debate about whether the fairly widespread fear of snakes is inborn, primal, or cultural? How do people look at that one, just for one?
Yeah, that's really interesting. An anthropologist named Lynn Isbell was going for a jog in the grasslands of Kenya a number of years ago. And all of a sudden, she froze, and she didn't know why. And it was only after she'd stood there for a minute that she saw the snake and registered it. Something in her subconscious had seen the snake before she even knew it. And that made her wonder what it was in our brains that were so cued to recognize a snake more than, for example, you know, a frog or an acorn or a flower. And she actually has discovered now that there are special neurons in the brain that evolved specifically to recognize snakes.
Snakes in particular.
Snakes in particular, because they were one of the biggest threats to our human ancestors and our pre-human ancestors. And so snakes are even responsible for probably why we have such fantastic visual perception, especially in our peripheral vision.
Because they're not easy to pick out in any environment, really.
That's right. And the animals who could pick them out were the ones who survived. So we know that primates, for example, who evolved in places like Madagascar, mm-hmm. where there are no poisonous snakes, they do not have good peripheral vision.
That is fascinating. Fear driving that, in a sense, leaving our brains, as you say, hardwired for fear.
Our brains are definitely hardwired for fear, and it looks like they're hardwired for snakes.
To the point where we think of it as a matter of speech, but we can smell fear.
Well, literally, we can smell fear. There have been some experiments with people who jump out of planes who are skydivers wearing T-shirts, and then the experimenters will give those T-shirts to subjects in a lab along with T-shirts from people who didn't jump out of the plane.
How do they respond? What's the difference?
Well, so the sniffers, the sniffers who smelled the T-shirts of the sky jumpers, their bodies responded by having a fear response. Their cortisol levels went up, their heart rates increased. And they actually smelled fear.
I don't think T-shirt sniffers have ever come up on this show before, but that is fascinating. I want to come back to this, what an old sensation thing fear is, even older, even predating the drive to reproduce. There you almost stumped me, because without the drive to reproduce, who's around to fear? But that's old indeed.
Well, you wouldn't be able to reproduce if you weren't alive.
True,
so,
fair.
You know, the brain is a 3-pound organ of survival. And that's its main mission.
You say, thanks to fear, we have Proust. Take us through that from the swamp fears about snakes to Proust and his Madelines.
Okay, so one of the ways fear works is that it encodes memory into our brain.
It actually releases calcium in the brain, and calcium is somehow related to the capture of memory.
That helps us encode mm-hmm. the memory of the fearful event. Mm-hmm. And so really, we have two things going on when we see a threat. We see the threat itself, but we also see our sort of response to the threat, mm-hmm. which is, you know, based in what may have happened to us earlier in our lives.
Okay. I'm still not to Proust. How do we get there?
Well, Proust is all about memory. The reason we remember anything mm-hmm. is because we have to remember fear.
So that kind of hardwired fear, hardwired memory that follows from it, and pretty soon we're thinking back, thank you, fear, for good memories.
That's right.
It protects us. It can also hijack us, you write.
Fear is a complicated emotion, because we think of it as keeping us from danger, but sometimes it does that a little bit too well. And it sometimes keeps us from enjoying experiences we're having. Mm-hmm. It can hijack us and hamstring us. It can also actually harm our survival instincts. Sometimes when we get so afraid of something, we freeze. And in fact, people who take outdoor groups into the field, who have a lot of experience with hazards on ice fields and ski slopes and big waves, sometimes they'll say that most people actually are bewildered in the face of a serious threat. They just kind of don't know what to do.
Interesting. Now, you write a lot about extreme sports people here. We're going to talk with them later in this hour. What's your assessment? They actually seek fear at some level. If you're a mountain climber or skydiver or you name it, are these individuals who have an innate response that is not bewilderment or paralysis, or have they just somehow drawn to it enough that they've overcome those things?
Yeah, that's right. I think most of us have this kind of bewildered or frozen response. Mm-hmm. But there are people at either end of the curve who seem to either completely fall apart or have this kind of preternatural calm when faced with a threat. Mm-hmm. And I think some of those people are drawn to adventure sports. And it's kind of what we call the fighter pilot profile. These are qualities we really admire, people who can perform incredibly well under pressure. They are able to stay rational and reasonable and react incredibly quickly, where most of us would kind of put up our hands and freak out.
You write that fear serves two main purposes. Give us those, Florence.
Fear keeps us alive, And it also burns.
That is, jack up your adrenaline enough to fight the threat, as you say.
Well, that's the idea, that it creates a physiological response, increases our heart rate. It takes blood away from our extremities into our heart so that we can fight or flee. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing it does is that it encodes that memory in our brain. It burns it in there so that we will never face that threat again.
This is memory. It can also turn into PTSD.
Well, PTSD is sometimes considered a disease of fear. It's sort of a fear hangover. And I really feel for people who have PTSD because they're in a constant state of hazard alert that they can't really get out of. And it's a very uncomfortable place to be. And it's very hard to sort of cure this hangover.
Interestingly, you write that women tend to suffer more from anxiety, but maybe less likely or more likely to develop PTSD?
I think the jury is perhaps still out on that. Part of why it's complicated to study fear in gender is that so many of our, you know, male and female responses are, you know, coded by culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes women express their fears and express their emotions more than men do, who maybe just hide it better.
We're in a time when fear is a factor out there, whether it's Ebola or ISIS and beheading or longer-term fears, climate change and all the rest, how we handle that fear, what we do with that very human response is a big deal. Florence Williams writes about it all in the November issue of Outside Magazine. She's with us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about fear, what it is, what drives it, fans it, how to conquer it in a time of Ebola and ISIS and a sense of general unease. Sometimes we seek it out for kicks. Here's a haunted house in Pontiac, Michigan, the Erebus house. Travel Channel brings it to us.
It was the scariest thing I've ever done in my entire life. No time to catch your breath. No time to stop your heart from racing. They were just constantly at you the whole time.
Woo, let's have more of that. We go to movies that scare us. World War Z, United Nations employee Jerry Lane, played by Brad Pitt, must stop a zombie pandemic threatening the world.
We've lost the East Coast. Moscow's still dark. Life as we know it will come to an end in 90 days. It's on us to change that.
I can't leave my family.
Don't pretend your family is exempt. When we talk about the end of humanity.
But it doesn't always come with timpani drums. Toastmasters International offers workshops to help people overcome their fear of public speaking. Just do more of it. Here's one tip.
If you want to overcome nervousness, the first guideline is simply to know what you're talking about. You'll have an easier time giving a speech on a subject if you know the subject well.
The heart pumping in the face of a public speech. Florence Williams is with me in the studio. Randy's calling from Corydon, Indiana. Randy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I have read a quote from years back attributed to Mark Twain about fear indirectly. He said that, he defined it, courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And... I've had instances in my life where, people trying to really hurt me or kill me.
Name one.
And name one?
Mm.
Someone pointing a loaded rifle at you as a kid.
And were you running or what was
it? No, I was standing there and I then took it away from them. But that was not the... the only time that I've, the one time.
So what have you learned? Is it just a negative, or can it be a positive fear, Randy?
As long as you don't allow yourself to be overwhelmed by it. Experience. If you've had a similar experience, you can focus in on that moment and evaluate it. there's a lot of, from my own experience, a lot of very intense focus on what's going on and evaluating it. And,
you know, Randy,
how I'm feeling. And
in that moment, Randy, you take us right on to the beam that Florence Williams reports. And we're going to hear in just a moment from Kevin LaBarre in Durham, North Carolina. I appreciate your call, Randy. Florence, this is exactly the kind of upside of fear if one is not overwhelmed by it or paralyzed by it, as Randy says. This intense focus it can produce that can lead to almost peak performance.
I think Randy hit it on the head with the word focus. And what I've learned from talking to some of these extreme athletes is that they consider fear almost another form of energy, that it crystallizes their focus to the point where they can go to places and go to levels of achievement that they've never been to before.
In what kinds of sports, for example?
For example, free soloing, you know, when they're climbing walls, you have to be
mountain climbing.
Yeah, rock climbing, mountain
rock
climbing, high line walking, where you're walking on a tightrope suspended, you know, 1,000 feet above two
canyons.
And
your fear is perfectly legitimate.
Your fear is perfectly legitimate, but you have to control it and you have to stay in the present.
And if you do that, you may be more in the present than you ever would be otherwise.
You have this incredibly heightened sense of the present moment, an incredibly heightened sense of life. They say that in those moments, they are more alive than they ever are.
Do people get addicted to that? Because, you know, every day I come in and do this on the air live, and I have some little inkling of what they may be feeling there. It's right here, and it does create a kind of heightened sense of the moment.
Sure. I think any experience that provides that level of bliss is bound to become a little bit addictive. You're going to want to seek it again and again.
One of the scientists that you've spoken with at some length for this terrific article is Kevin LaBarre. He's professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at Duke University. He joins us now from Durham, North Carolina. He uses virtual reality to track how people respond to stimuli that induce fear. Professor LaBarre, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
How does your research work? You throw somebody into a Rubik's Cube of fear simulation, Florence describes it. How's it work?
Sure. We put people into a cube that basically projects a virtual environment, and then we can place things in that environment, like snakes and spiders. And in some situations, we can have people associate, say, the snake with something really aversive, like a shock or even a loud noise. And then we can measure their physiological responses to see how they acquire those fears and then how they can get rid of them, and also how changes in context will cause a return of fear.
Florence writes that fear can be both or either a lock and or a key. Does that resonate with you?
I think what she's relating to here are individual differences, how some people can be debilitated by the fear. Other people can learn to conquer those fears. And so it can really go either way.
Is it changeable, or are you in one category or the other by either birth or upbringing, by experience?
Well, genetics and experience play a big role, but we are also training people with techniques in terms of how to conquer those fears. And some of them are things like just simply exposing yourself to the situation again and with nothing aversive happening. That's called exposure therapy or extinction therapy. You can also reframe that fear by using your cognitive resources to say, well, this is something that maybe happened in the past, or maybe this wasn't so bad after all, to rethink that experience in a different way.
What happens when a person is struck with fear? What chemically happens, if that's the right word?
Sure. Well, Florence mentioned the amygdala, which is a brain region that really helps to mobilize those defensive responses, and the amygdala gets very active. The amygdala happens to be one of the most densely interconnected structures in the brain, so it can reach out to these sensory regions. It can reach down into release stress hormones and basically kind of take over in the moment what's happening. And then to regulate that, you really want to kind of engage your frontal lobe to downregulate that amygdala response.
Stress hormones, like what? Because I heard dopamine come up, I think I read, come up in this article, which I don't think of as a stress hormone. I think of it as a pleasure hormone.
Well, I think dopamine comes into play when we're talking about extreme sports in terms of the thrill-seeking aspect. It's what makes the thrill-seeking so rewarding and reinforcing, and it motivates them to want to do this again.
So the stress hormones give them the focus to accomplish the extreme sport activity, let's say, and then the dopamine is the reward?
Yes.
Amazing. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. John, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, I guess you'd call me sort of an extreme sports enthusiast. I like to do a lot of cave diving and deep scuba diving. In fact, I'm just returning from a trip to Upper Michigan where we were doing some deep diving into flooded copper mines from the 1850s this weekend. And I just want to say that I don't seek these activities because I enjoy the fear. In fact, I don't like being scared. And there's been many cases where I've been terrified, and I don't like that feeling. I seek this because of the technical aspect of it, because I get to see things other people have never seen, or I get to go places where very few people get to go. So there's a risk versus reward. If I want this reward, I have to accept the risk.
Are you saying, John, that you are fearless? Because, I mean, to me, the idea of going down in, I guess, a deep flooded copper mine, that would certainly create anxiety and probably in me fear. But you have no fear of it, so fear is not even a factor?
Oh, I do. I do have fear of it. In fact, I often say the day that I stop being afraid of doing this, the day I need to stop, because that's when I'm going to get complacent. The fear keeps my edge, keeps me safe.
Do you do it to see what's down there, or do you do it to get into that zone where you're so hyper-focused because of the fear that perhaps you can accomplish things you wouldn't otherwise?
I do both those things, and I definitely notice that hyper-focused zone. It relieves me of all my stress from my everyday life because I can focus only on this activity and I forget about everything else. So in that regard, it's therapeutic for me.
Wow, to go diving in a flooded, deep copper mine, that's terrific. John, I appreciate your call. Kevin Labar, what portion of people have that sort of fear response that leads them to come back to it again and again that may take them down in a flooded mine?
I think you're talking about really people that are thrill seekers, that people that are novelty seeking or sensation seeking. And, you know, what John is saying is it's that aspect of it that he finds rewarding. It's really not the fear that's motivating this per se, but it's, you know, that sense of accomplishment and that sense of conquering that, which is really driving this behavior.
I want to go to Bob in Georgetown, South Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering about what I experience as or call perceived fear. In other words, when I listen to this committee in my head and worry about future events that probably never will materialize, and I experience it as most people do, as anxiety. And what is the relationship between anxiety and fear?
That is an interesting question. I'll put that to both of my guests. Florence, let me take that one first to you.
Well, the way I understand it is that anxiety is really about a future threat, mm-hmm. and fear is about a threat that's occurring right now. So, unfortunately, we sort of misuse the word fear, I think, often. And, Kevin, you can tell me if I'm right here.
Kevin, fear and anxiety, how do you distinguish?
I think Florence is exactly right. You know, we confuse those terms. Anxiety is really about something that might happen in the future. So when we think about terrorism, whereas fear is in the moment, like in the moment of 9/11.
But, you know, in the end, you can define it how you like. I think society has its own role. And if we say we're afraid of another 9/11, that has to be a legitimate use of the word in maybe not a scientific way, but certainly in a cultural way. When you've watched the response to the threat of Ebola, Professor Labar, what's it brought to mind for you as a scientist who studies fear?
Well, I think there's several aspects of it. I mean, one thing is kind of the fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. Another issue is the fear of death. And another issue is kind of the fear of strangers. This is coming from a strange culture, primarily in West Africa, that we don't know a lot about. And so there are a lot of fears that get wrapped up in this. But there's also a very strong social component to this. We learn a lot about fear from observing others in fear. And so if some people are expressing their fears and we're watching these coverage on TV, then that tends to affect us. And there's regions in the brain that respond both when you're observing somebody in fear as well as having a fear reaction yourself.
So fear is a very social thing, Florence.
It is, and I think a really important point to make about Ebola is that not just is it a contagious disease, but fear is actually contagious as well. And in fact, it's more contagious right now
than Ebola itself
in the United States than Ebola itself.
We're talking about fear, what it is, what drives it, what fans it, how to conquer it. I want to talk with someone who's done just that. Greg Long joins us right now from San Clemente, California, professional big wave surfer, big wave world champion in 2013. Right near the end of 2012, he very nearly died in a surfing accident. Greg Long, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What happened in that accident? Describe it for us.
I was surfing an underwater seamount 100 miles off the coast of Southern California called the Cortez Bank during one of our very large winter swells.
Okay.
And it's basically the equivalent. It'd be our Mount Everest of big wave surfing. A lot of extreme conditions, mm-hmm. Aside from just the big waves itself. But ended up going down on a wipeout, falling at the bottom of the wave, and under such force in the ocean, was held under for four consecutive waves actually until I lost consciousness.
How long might that have been, Greg? I'm sure it seemed like 100 years, but in fact,
it was equivalent to about 90 seconds, mm-hmm. Actually being held down and kind of thrashed beneath the ocean until I did actually black out. And then I was underwater for about another 90 seconds before my rescue team was able to locate my body, which was floating face down, and get me up and out of the water. So it was what is clinically considered a non-fatal drowning.
You have a lot of experience with extreme conditions. How did that condition your response to this fear-inducing, in most people, very fear-inducing situation?
It really shook my world up, to say the least. That I had always really been motivated and inspired by these feelings of fear. They're so common and regular. When I'd be out there surfing big waves, one of the greatest allures was that challenge to interpret it and learn to interpret in a positive way and use it, to motivate me to go out there and do it time again. As we've heard a few guests come on and say that, that's one of the reasons they do their activities. But immediately after, I was introduced to a whole new side of fear that I had never experienced before, where, it literally became that, paralyzing, sensation that, what I'd built my life on, this love and passion for the ocean, riding big waves, I would step foot in the water and there's this immediate, return to, the physical agony that I was going through in those moments, and then just literally that. I would become, paralyzed in that moment, and I couldn't even, go surfing for some time after.
Would you call that a kind of PTSD, or how do you think of it?
I talked to a handful of people, and they would interpret it that way. I like to see it simply as another, version of fear, another face of it. For me, the way I was able to move through it was simply interpreting it as, okay, emotions that are being evoked by a past circumstance, experience, whether it's post-traumatic stress or not, but mm-hmm. simply information that here's a new challenge for you. That I interpret fear, all the things that induce that in my life, simply as challenges somewhere that I'm unfamiliar with. This kind of, as I was speaking earlier, this unknown in your
mm-hmm.
life,
mm-hmm.
and as I always had before, I simply look at it as, places where I can grow and evolve from. So rather than shying and running the other way, I stood there and I really analyzed, okay, what is it that's, provoking me to react this way, this sort of stimulus response reaction, which is what most people sort of succumb to. But, what I learned through big wave surfing, for doing it, 15 years, that in every one of those moments, every circumstance that we encounter in our life, that we have free will to interpret and, choose how we want to react. As long as we don't give in to that initial, knee-jerk reaction that we've just, been conditioned and accustomed to displaying in those moments that, invoke fear in our lives. And
As individuals, we can do that, and maybe as a society, we can do that as well. Greg Long, stand by in San Clemente. I want to explore exactly that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about fear. Leaders understand fear. Politicians can use it to be elected. They can talk about it to try and calm a nation. Here was FDR in his first inaugural address, famous lines from 1933.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
And here's a little Dallas reaction last week to Ebola. This was Dr. Martin McAleer at the Neighborhood Medical Center telling CNN he's seeing a lot more patients worried about Ebola, including Keisha Bell, who came in with abdominal pains. He asked her what made the pain worse.
I think if I have something spicy.
Okay, got it. What makes the pain better? Anything?
No.
Keisha will have further testing for a possible gallbladder condition. But the doctor told her this has nothing to do with Ebola.
Most people just want reassurance.
And these days in Dallas, there's never too much of that.
But maybe Ebola is exactly what she was worried about right there, afraid of. Florence Williams joins us this hour. She's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine. Her big piece is The Science of Conquering Your Greatest Fears. Kevin LaBarre is here from Durham, North Carolina, studies fear at Duke University. Great to have him here. And Greg Long is with us from San Clemente, California, big wave world champion, professional surfer 2013 champ, who was held under a series of gigantic waves that he escaped but was left with lingering deep fear of that kind of environment. He got over it. Lots of response here online. Dizzy says to us, sure, lots of fears are irrational and not based in reality, but my fear of spiders, now that's perfectly rational and logical fear. Everybody thinks their own is, of course. Kim says, in emergencies, pilots are afraid, but turning to training and taking quick action calms the fearful mind. And Tracy has a question I'm going to put to you, Kevin LaBarre. She says, I have a 9-year-old daughter with an extreme fear of thunderstorms, constant anxiety over clouds. This creates a physical reaction of nausea, diarrhea, completely debilitating. And to her and us as a family, we've tried everything, psychologists, exposure therapy, hypnotism, yoga, you name it. The only thing left is to try medication. We don't want to go there. We live, eat, breathe her fear, and it's terribly sad as a parent to watch your child grow through it. What can you say about that kind of condition, Kevin?
Without knowing that specific case, it's hard to give a specific detailed answer. But, I would go through all those routes. You know, I would try to get if exposure therapy didn't work, then you try to get the child to reframe the fear in some way to say, you know, this is nothing that's going to harm you, and to try to think of it as just an event that's more remote from your experiences.
Greg Long, how did you condition yourself to get over that fear of water, just getting your ankles in the water, that deep pounding under the big waves gave you?
For me, it was the desire to move through it. That's one of the most imperative aspects that, unless you truly want to get past that, you know, you're always going to kind of remain on, you know, being forced to feel that way. So, you know, it comes from the desire. And then just the regular exposure, and again, not reacting immediately as soon as those feelings would, you know, arise, but rather analyzing, okay, what is it that's invoking them, and, you know, responding with, you know, analytical decision making. And so little by little, I'll admit it's still a work in progress almost mm-hmm. 2 years later to mm-hmm. regain that full confidence that I had. But, you know, it has come back, and I'm finding myself, you know, enjoying, you know, riding big waves, you know, just as much as I used to.
Florence, you've talked with a lot of extreme sports people, athletes and others, about how they harness fear. Take us further into that relationship that they develop with fear that in the positive cases allows them to go to peak performance instead of paralysis.
Yeah, they say that having that kind of fear really brings them into the moment in a way that few other life experiences can do. They find
there's the focus piece of it.
There's the focus piece. There's this sensory piece.
Smells, heightened awareness.
Exactly. Smells are stronger. The visual stronger. Some people go into a sort of a tunnel vision where really it's a distraction-free moment for them. And some people describe this as flow, mm-hmm. which is kind of the flip side of fear, when you can take this energy and harness it.
It would be great if, as a society in moments of fear, as FDR was trying to urge there, I guess, we said, no, we're not going to the panicky paralysis mode. We're going to go to this hyper-effective mode. Kevin LaBarre, is there any evidence that these dynamics can work out collectively or socially, more adept processing of fear?
I think there's little science on, you know, how this can be, how you can use groups to help overcome this, because we tend to focus on individual people when we study things scientifically. But certainly there is sort of the collective experience of emotion can change that emotion in individuals. So I think there are opportunities for that to happen here.
Is there individual predisposition at play when fear suddenly emerges? Are some just somehow biologically equipped to turn their reaction more toward focus and heightened sensory perception that enables them, that empowers them? Are others more, you know, predisposed to panic or paralysis?
Sure. So there's individual differences in neurohormone distribution and genetics. People have personalities where they tend to be more trait anxious than other people. And those are the people that have the harder time in managing fears in the long run.
What does trait anxious mean?
It just means you have a personality distribution to respond more to negative events than other people. So you're more fear reactive.
One of the things, Tom, that really sort of made an impression on me in writing this article was how many people have taught themselves how to conquer fear. And there are a number of techniques that they say have worked for them.
Let's hear them.
One really important one that I hear about a lot is the breath. In fact, I talked to Kaya Tursky, who she was an Olympic slopestyle skier with sort of crippling anxiety. But she underwent some training that taught her to breathe and focus on the moment. You sort of use her breath to stay in the present moment, which is really sort of mindfulness. And in fact, it's so effective that even the Marines are now using this.
So turning your attention away from the boogeyman thought to actually focusing on your own breath as you face the threat or the fear source.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really important to remember that when we are facing a fearful event or a threatening event, the brain is kind of at war with itself. You know, the amygdala is sending out this alarm, these stress signals. But the sort of newly evolved part of the brain, the neocortex, is more rational and reasoned and can say, wait a minute, that's a rubber snake. It's not a real snake. So if you can find ways to sort of calm down that amygdala and heighten the cortical response, then I think you're ahead of the game.
Kevin, do you have sort of hip pocket the tricks that help people go toward the focus and flow rather than the flight and panic?
Sure. Well, I agree with the deep breathing. So we've studied deep breathing in the brain, and we see how that can help calm down these limbic centers that get very aroused. And that's, of course, you know, some of the basis of meditation and yoga practices is also to, you know, focus on that internal relaxation state.
Zach in Norfolk, Virginia. Zach, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hey. Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
Yeah. Quick question. Okay. Number one, when I was listening to the show, I got this feeling in my hand as soon as she mentioned solo rock climbing. And anytime I see a video or even hear about it, it's crazy. My hands will hurt, and then I'll get the sweaty palms.
Zach, are you a climber, may I ask?
I actually do climb, and I do a number of, I guess, fear-inducing activities, I would say. It's kind of...
Do you get sweaty palms when you climb? Does it happen to you when you climb? That sounds kind of dangerous.
I'm not an avid climber. I mess around with it. But, I do, you know, it does affect me, but I'm able to control it. But thinking about it and watching other people do it seems to have a whole different effect on me. And it's like an instant thing. My palms become, and I don't normally have sweaty palms for other reasons.
Right.
You know, that's the only thing. So I was just wondering if that ties into anything that, why sweaty palms?
That's
why
wild. Kevin LaBarre, just the thought of it or watching someone else do it. And Zach's got sweaty palms there.
Sure.
Trace that back for us.
Well, that sweaty palm reaction is part of the fight or flight response that everybody has. So when you give a public speech, you can get sweaty palms as well.
Why would that have been evolutionarily advantageous to have sweaty palms when you run faster with sweaty palms?
That is not so clear. It's thought something to do with friction and grip and things like this. But, you know, they're just so stories, I think.
Okay. The watching of it, though, being more fear-inducing than the actual doing.
Sure. Well, some studies have shown that just the social observation of fear, you know, watching somebody else be in a threatening situation, can also target this amygdala response, and that itself can actually generate this sweating behavior.
So watch the evening news where the stretcher comes off the plane, and boom, there you go. Neil in Virginia Beach. Virginia, Neil, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Mine is a little different. I'm not really totally adventuresome, but I really didn't have much fear. And my experience goes to operating a bucket truck, 65 foot, which puts you up in the air, you know, over 70 feet high.
Yeah.
Could go up there, spin around, no problems, no hesitation, no worries, anything whatsoever. I had a car accident. About 6 months after the car accident, I got back in the bucket truck for a routine thing and went to go up. And I shook my knees. My whole body trembled. I could not move. It was not a bucket truck accident. It was vehicular.
Right.
But it paralyzed me, and I couldn't do anything. And it probably took me an hour to get, like, 10 feet up. I had to get back down out of the truck, walk around.
What do you think was going on there, Neil? Do you think your sense of invulnerability was punctured by the automobile accident, and that extended to your high bucket?
It didn't seem like it. It was something about that lightness. It felt like that as I was going, started to go up, and I lost that gravity, that something just changed in my body, and I shook like crazy. I can't explain it. I mean, I can go up now, not as it takes me a while, but what I need to do is go up to an elevation higher than that, very slow,
yeah,
and then come back down, and then I can work.
Wow, that's some story. I think I can relate to this. I know after I've had an automobile accident or two, and afterward, the sense of driving, you know, normally we drive around and feel nothing's going to happen. You get in an accident, you realize you're in a tin can and it can crumple like anything else. What do you make of that story, Florence, from our caller, Neil?
I think your caller makes an interesting point that by getting back into it very gradually, mm-hmm. he was able to sort of manage it better. And that's another one of the strategies that I heard about, sort of baby steps, sort of get slowly more comfortable with, each new level of this fear response or the threat.
Greg Long, did your trauma bleed fear over into other areas of your life, or was it just waves and water?
It was really just relegated to waves and water. And then, you know, going back into the small waves, I became, you know, comfortable, you know, rather quickly. But on the biggest days when I would go out, as Florence was just addressing, that, mm-hmm. you know, I was instantly just so overwhelmed. And so really what I did is, as she was saying, you know, started kind of back at the beginning of, you know, almost relearning how to ride big waves again and, you know, staying in a place where I was comfortable, right at kind of that threshold of my vulnerabilities and, you know, surfing at that level until, you know, I regained that confidence. And then I would, you know, try and progress into slightly larger waves. And, you know, it's been 2 years now and I'm finally, you know, I feel like I'm just coming back to, you know, to where I once was before my accident.
Baby steps and back in the big pool, the Pacific. Ray in Miami, Florida. Ray, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I've been a conference speaker for almost 40 years. Mm-hmm. And one of the groups that I spoke to, which was a company that was involved in military contracts, afterwards, a two-star general came up to me. And he said, I really admire you being so calm and collected. He said, I'm not exaggerating, but I would rather go into combat than get up in front of an audience. And he was serious. Yeah. And he said, please come to lunch and anything you could do to help me. Well, we sat down at lunch, and I just gave him what I thought. I said, well, first of all, any performer or any speaker or anybody who gets up in front of an audience, if they tell you they're not nervous or don't get butterflies, mm-hmm. they're not telling you the truth. I said, the idea is that you get butterflies, take them, and get them to all fly in the same direction. And
orchestrate your fear, and you may have something good come out of it.
Well, and also I said some people picture their audience, everybody with no clothes on. That doesn't work for me. I get too distracted. So I said, but it helps to speak to one individual in the audience as opposed to speaking to what you think is a group. At least those are little tips.
Yeah, no, that's great. In a way, that's a way of focusing down the issue or the threat or the environment by thinking of one. Kevin LeVar, why would people be so afraid of standing in front of an audience? These aren't people who are going to come after you. They're just sitting there. What makes us afraid in that circumstance?
It's just an aspect of social anxiety. So it's just an individual difference. Some people just really have a fear of speaking in large groups. And so I think the idea of just focusing on one person is a really good strategy in that case.
Florence, sit back and look at our big old country here. At the moment, fears on many fronts. This pushes beyond where you actually took the article, I guess. But be our wise one for the day. If we want to respond effectively as a community in the face of potentially fear-inducing circumstances, what have you learned? What would you suggest?
I think what we need to do is find voices of reason. And I use that word reason really deliberately because, again, that's what's going to combat the fear response from our amygdala. So we need leaders who can sort of create a calmer discussion over mm-hmm. these really, you know, controversial topics and scary topics. I think for some of us individually, we need to be careful about how we allocate, you know, sort of our news diet, maybe sometimes turning off the TV, which tends to sensationalize images. Maybe getting our news more from newspapers or from sort of rational radio. I think that it's going to be really important to also not expose children to these images because we know that fear is especially contagious for them right now.
And if we do those things and focus on effective response, maybe that initial fear turns it into something more positive. Maybe you actually get results out of this.
Well, maybe we can learn something about these events next time they happen.
That would be great. Florence Williams with Outside Magazine, Kevin LeVar at Duke University Medical School, Greg Long in San Clemente. Thanks to all of you. We will be fearless. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.